Support for KNKX and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, reminding listeners that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
TV is just like making cheese. People consume cheese. Some people make really good cheese. Other people make really terrible cheese. But everybody eats cheese, and I make the cheese.
Hey, I'm Jennifer Wing, and this is Steve Wilson. He directs and produces TV shows, and he says he makes really good cheese. Steve grew up in Seattle in the 1960s, a golden age in television for kids, when King, Cairo, and Como created their own shows for children. Steve, he watched them all.
So here in Seattle, we had Stan Borson on Channel 5, J.P. Patches was on Channel 7, Captain Puget was on Channel 4, and Channel 11 had Brakeman Bill. To me, television was magic. It's like, these were guys that, you know, were your friends.
In 1962, Steve went to the World's Fair at Seattle Center. This was the first time he saw how his friends on television came to life. He witnessed the cheese being made.
I was 6 years old at the time. King had set up shop, and they had their studios there, a live studio, so you could watch the TV shows live. And we walked by right as Wanda Wanda, which was a kid's show aimed at kids that were like four. And I saw her, and I went, oh, my God, there's Wanda Wanda. She's right there. There's her house. So we stopped, and my mom let us sit down and watch. Then at the very end of the show fades to black, of course. It's off the air, and the stagehands go in, and they start actually dismantling the house, tearing it down. And I went, what are you doing? You're tearing down. Don't you guys, that's her house. What are you doing? And my mom had to actually physically restrain me and say, no, honey, it's pretend. It's all pretend. That's when I kind of woke up and I looked around and I saw the lights and I saw the cameras and I saw the monitors and I went, oh, I get it now. And once they swept the set, they dropped this canvas thing down and it said King's Clubhouse. And half hour later, here comes Stan with the accordion and the red lights go on and I can see that the cameras are in place and I can see the monitors. I go, I get it now. And I was just enthralled, not only that I was in the presence of Stan and actually seeing the actual show live, but there were different camera angles and there were guys running big booms and things like that. There was a whole bunch going on here. I was just fascinated by that. My brothers and I, we went home and we got apple boxes and I stood one up on its side, stacked it so it looked like a camera. And I wrote King 5 on there with the crown and I drew lenses and a viewfinder. And so we would play Stan Borson. And so one guy got to be Stan Borson and two kids got to be the cameraman. And we'd pretend like we were holding a microphone. I mean, I staged it all out. So we were actually playing TV like we had learned at the World's Fair.
Some magic happened in you that day. Something shifted in you as a six-year-old child.
I would say that point, that one particular point where I got to peek behind the curtain and see what was going on. That piqued my interest in no other way that I can compare it to.
Today on Sound Effect, the theme is turning point. It's the moment when a situation changes or an emotion shifts. Coming up, we'll learn how a really tall Christmas tree determined the future of Northgate Mall in Seattle. And what would you do if you suddenly found yourself stranded on a deserted island? We'll hear how one family's sailing trip got sidetracked when they failed to make a turn. These stories and more just ahead on Sound Effect. So that Christmas tree in Northgate Mall. Back in 1950, Northgate Mall was just opening its doors. It was struggling to get traction and fill empty shops. big local retailers like Nordstrom didn't believe that a regional shopping center all the way up north could survive. At the time, downtown Seattle was where people went to shop. A man named Jim Douglas set out to change this. Jim helped launch major legacies like Seafair and the World's Fair, but his crowning achievement was saving Northgate. Jim ran the mall from 1949 to 1976, and in the mall's early days, he saved it from financial ruin with the help of one very tall Christmas tree. Jim isn't around to tell his story that involved making the impossible happen. He died in 2005 at the age of 95, but he shared his stories with his young cousin, C.R. Douglas. Today, C.R. is a political analyst for Q13 News. We sat down in front of Northgate Mall with C.R. to talk about how Jim and this incredibly tall tree turned things around.
Well, the biggest thing Jim knew during that first year was that Christmas and the holiday season had to succeed. If you can't get sales, because those are really the best months of the year, then there was no reason for Northgate to exist. He knew that that first Christmas was make or break for Northgate.
So he had to go big. How did he do that?
They came up with this idea of the tallest Christmas tree in the world.
The world.
The world. Up to then, I think it had been 100, 120 feet, something like that. They wanted to get to 200 feet, and it was a financial risk. He thought they could probably do it for $3,000. It ended up costing almost 10 times that amount, nearly $30,000. They found a tree at an Enumclaw that they thought could work. Trees like that that grow in a forest have branches at the top, but they're mostly branchless at the bottom because the light is shaded. So they got a tree that looked like that, and they actually cut off all the branches. So it was just one big spire, if you will, one big pole, and it was a feat just to get it down without breaking it. And then transporting a 200-foot tree to Seattle was pretty difficult in those days. Remember, 1950, we didn't have all the kind of, you know, equipment, trucks to carry this kind of thing.
Yes, because there was no I-5 at the time. There wasn't a straight shot up the freeway. You had these surface streets. How did they make turns transporting the tree from Enumclaw to the mall?
It was very difficult, and they had a lot of help along the way. I mean, they had city engineers and probably had the police force and other people helping. But they used two trucks, in effect, one for the front of the tree and one for the back of the tree. So the middle of the tree, you know, well over 100 feet, was just kind of hanging in between the two. So they would go around a corner, and then that tree sometimes would kind of scrape on the sidewalk or scrape on the street, especially if they were going over a hill. I mean, that thing went up and down Pine Street. It did make turns. It was tough. It's a great story up in Lake City where they weren't able to make one turn and they had to go a couple miles detour and finally were able to make another turn. But it was hit or miss and a high-risk endeavor just to see if you could get that thing in one piece all the way up here to Northgate, never mind put the thing up. It was as though it was the Olympic torch relay. You know where you have cities that have the Olympic torch run through before the games? I mean, this thing had a three-day travel, and Jim was smart enough to know that that was worthy of attention, and the media did cover the tree, and Seattleites followed it.
So it arrives here at the mall, and it's just the beginning that it gets here in one piece. What did they have to do to set this thing up?
Well, the biggest thing they had to do was actually put branches back on it. I mean, once they got the thing up and they had guy wires, they had about 5 truckloads of branches, all of different sizes, that they were able to get from other trees, and actually branched the tree up. I mean, created a tree out of what was just kind of a large pole.
It was like a big toothpick.
And they made it look like this beautiful tree that was all one piece.
So they have this beautiful Frankenstein tree that has been repackaged, and it's standing 212 feet in the air. How did they engineer that?
Well, they had a lot of guy wires and must have had a very big base that it set in. But again, no one had ever done this. This was the world's largest and tallest cut Christmas tree. And I think they were inventing it as they went. They put lights on it. They decorated it. I mean, it was all beautiful. And then, within just a couple days of that thing going up, Seattle had one of the biggest windstorms of the decade. I mean, 60-mile-an-hour winds rushed through Northgate right when this tree was basically just going light. It was crazy. They almost lost the thing just after having put it up.
So what happened to it?
It weathered the storm somehow. They must have shorted up a little more than they would have otherwise, but mostly they crossed their fingers. They dodged a bullet with that windstorm.
So it's the world's tallest Christmas tree. This must have gotten some amount of publicity.
It got a huge amount of publicity. And Jim, who was really a showman and a promoter, knew and saw what he could get out of that. Obviously, the local papers were taking notice, but the biggest turning point for the tree was when Life magazine, the nation's preeminent magazine at that point, decided to do a story and feature this tree. So they came out, had some pictures actually of the tree traveling, and then had this enormous, big, glossy photo of the Northgate tree all lit up with the headline to the effect, the world's tallest Christmas tree. I mean, it was PR gold. And of course, it led to then more media outlets, papers and dailies across America. I mean, it did become the Guinness World Book record holder for the tallest cut Christmas tree, and it remains the Guinness Book World Record tallest cut Christmas tree. And that tree changed everything for Northgate. It ensured that crowds came, it helped retailers generate buzz, and Northgate had an amazing first holiday season.
It was the giving tree, yeah.
It was the ultimate giving tree, and Jim had the foresight to know that that could happen.
When he would share these stories with you when you were growing up, how did he feel about this time in his life?
Well, he was a master storyteller, and I heard a lot of these as a kid, but really as an adult, when I spent so much time with him for his last 10 or 15 years of life, I really absorbed them. And I'd go down there almost once a week to his house, and we'd each have a gin martini, and it was like time travel. So many times it would come back to that Christmas tree, and you could tell in his voice how important that was to him and how excited he was about what it did, not just for Northgate and his own business success, but for the city. You know, Northgate became this really important cornerstone for the north part of Seattle.
Which until then had just been the burbs, right? Or pretty, not, I wouldn't say rural, but not a place that people visited very often.
I would say it was almost rural. The town was clearly heading north, and Jim had the foresight to see that you could build a regional shopping center that could help energize that growth north. And he also foresaw what it really became. I mean, Northgate has been an anchor for this enormous urban center we now see. I mean, with the college and with the business park and medical offices and all kinds of housing. I mean, this is kind of a model for growth management where people can live, work, play right in this area. I mean, it's been an important way of containing growth and channeling growth. I mean, if you had not had a Northgate, a whole hodgepodge of development would have happened here, probably haphazard, and none big enough to really anchor this neighborhood.
That was C.R. Douglas. He's a political analyst for Q13 News. He says that his cousin, Jim Douglas, was the person who had the idea for another huge shift in how people interact with retail, the pedestrian walkway, Northgate Mall was the first shopping center in America to have a small boulevard running through it for shoppers to meander on without the distraction of cars. It redefined the shopping experience for Northgate and for shopping centers and malls all over the country. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing, and today our theme is Turning Point. Marvin Charles is the co-founder of a Seattle organization called DADS. DADS stands for Divine Alternative for Dads Services. It helps men from all walks of life get back on their feet, find work, and ultimately reconnect with their kids. Now, with an organization like this, you must think that Marvin is one of these people who grew up in a wonderful, loving home himself. Well, it's how Marvin's life started, but then things got really complicated.
10 days before I turned 10, my mother died suddenly. And a relative came in and told us that your mother died. And that wasn't our mother. That's not our father.
Marvin and his sister found out they were adopted. The father they had known up to this point wasn't up to the task of raising these two kids on his own. He sent them to live with another relative in the family. This new home was fancier, there was more money, but it was abusive.
I remember my first punishment. I was playing with my sister in my bedroom. And I broke the window. And so the punishment was, I was asleep in that room all winter without fixing it. He had another one he did. He threatened to boil some eggs. And if I catch you lying, he would threaten to put a boiled egg in my mouth. Those were a number of the things that kept me scared to death to do anything.
When Marvin was 16 years old, he ran away. He lived with friends. He lived on the streets. He had a few jobs, but he left them to chase a dream of living a life of a hustler down in California.
In the 70s, there was a fascinating lifestyle. It was called the game. I wanted it.
What did the game involve?
Prostitution, drugs, a limelight, new cars, money.
This did not last. Marvin started using drugs. He was hooked.
But then there came a time in the late 80s where I had been overindulging. Babies were being born.
Your babies?
Yes. I had a 5-year-old son, my namesake. And I was not able to provide for him unless I was in a relationship with a woman.
And you were her pimp?
Yes.
Marvin moved back to Seattle. He worked odd jobs to support his drug habit. And then he met Jeanette. There was love. It was real. But they were both terribly damaged people.
We were all involved in using drugs together.
What kind of drugs?
Crack cocaine. And it was rampant. It was rampant. And I'm knowing all the time, this ain't good, but I'm so deep in this madness, I don't care. So then the state came in and took two of the children. I had a son when I met Jeanette. She had a son. And the state came and took the children because I left them at the daycare center.
In the middle of all of this, Marvin and Jeanette had a daughter. They named her Marvette.
She was literally born in the midst of a crack binge. And I remember 7 months later, Marvette was 7 months old, and I had become to be a caregiver to her, you know, fixing her bottles and helping her. Just, which kind of grew this attachment. And so one day somebody came into the home with some drugs, and I remember they gave me some, and I just didn't want it. I cussed everybody out in the house, and I took two cans of formula and four diapers, and I ran out the front door.
With diapers and formula in hand, Marvin took his 7-month-old daughter, Marvette, on a bus. He wanted her to have a better life, a home where people didn't knock on the door offering drugs. To make this possible, Marvin knew he had to give up his daughter. He took her to Child Protective Services.
I hadn't told Jeanette any of this, so she was pretty upset. So upset, so when I went back out to the car to strap the baby in the car seat and watch the car drive away. I went back to get back in the house, and I couldn't get back in. So immediately I was homeless again. And so I went to my sister's house. She had her three kids there, and it was a one bedroom, and I slept on the floor with a dog. And I remember thinking, dude, this is what your life is like. You're sleeping on the floor with the dog. I'll never forget that dog's name. It was Hershey. So from Hershey, I had to climb back up.
How'd you do that? How did you get clean after all those years?
I think it was determination to prove that I was not the person that I wound up being.
Marvin got into treatment. He got back together with Jeanette. And eventually, she entered treatment too. Then they went together to try and get their kids back from the state.
The state appointed us a caseworker, and the caseworker says, this is her fifth rodeo. She has no opportunity whatsoever to get the kids back, and yours is slim to none.
Fifth rodeo meaning?
5 times she's been in treatment on drugs and alcohol and the whole 9 yards. And then she made mention, if you guys were married, it'd be different. But she wasn't trying to encourage us to be married. I grabbed Jeanette by the hand after she walked away and said, if you'll marry me, I'll do everything in my power to make you the happiest woman in the world. And I had no references. but she said yes. So after getting married, she went back to treatment. She got out of treatment. We spent our first 6 months. She lived in one clean and sober house. I lived in another, and our curfew was 10 o'clock. And so the courts gave us stipulations, and we just one by one accomplished them.
Marvin and Jeanette didn't fight the system. They worked with it. They learned how to navigate its more complicated corners. They did this with the help of a community they created, their religious faith, the people who taught them their parenting classes. They got their kids out of foster care and brought them home. Marvin got a job, Jeanette did too, but childcare was too expensive, so she stayed home with the kids. Lots of people were watching Marvin and Jeanette reach goal after goal and not slip down a rung on the ladder. Friends and family with similar pasts wanted to know if this couple could help them. This was the beginning of their nonprofit, Dads.
There were people we got high with, we did time with, we did crime with, who were caught up in some of the same situations and circumstances that we were. And how could we take what we've learned and help them? And right away, one thing popped up pretty fast. And that was, Jeanette had child support payments and I didn't. A lot of families don't know that when your kids are in custody of the state, they generate a child support order that usually falls on the custodial parent. And at that time, Jeanette was considered the custodial parent that the kids were taken from. So she had a pretty extensive debt. How much did you owe child support?
$17,000 in arrears. So I had a caseworker I was sharing with them that you can't keep taking this money out of my check. I have kids to take care of. And they were like, you have kids to take care of? And so as I shared with them the incidences that the children came home, they said, well, we were unaware that the kids had came back. So they immediately started to work with me to make that payment manageable.
Jeanette started helping estranged fathers do the same. Make the payments, but get them lowered so you can still afford rent and food.
Some of her clients complain they're tired of paying if they don't even get to see their kids.
Well, our goal was to change, one, the mindset that is always going to be your child, whether you see them or not. Your responsibility to this child is to be there for them physically, financially, emotionally. So we found that teaching them how to first navigate the child support system to where it didn't feel so painful, opened their hearts, allowed their mindsets to say, okay, now I want to go and see if I can spend time with my child.
The work that Marvin and Jeanette are doing for them, it's like they're fighting a virus.
If you remove a father out of the home, the family doesn't die, but what it does, it opens it up for infection, teenage pregnancy, at-risk youth behavior. Those are the kind of things that we want to find a cure for. And we think that fatherhood plays a significant role in helping to cure that. It's not the cure-all, but it's part of it.
Families, they come in a lot of different iterations. Marvin and Jeanette don't care if it's two dads, two moms, whatever the combination. As long as there is some partnership looking out for that child with that child's interests in mind. Dad's operates out of an office on Rainier Avenue in Seattle, and they're opening another location in Tacoma. Marvette, who Marvin handed over to Child Protective Services 2 decades ago, is now a student at Langston University in Oklahoma. Marvin and Jeanette are involved with all of their kids, but Marvin says he is still trying to build a better relationship with one of his sons, who was the most affected by his chaotic earlier life. This is Sound Effect, and this next story is about the abrupt turn in life that happens when a group of people win a lottery. Not the money kind, the one with a different kind of green. Weed. After Washington State legalized recreational marijuana back in 2013, it held a lottery to award around 200 growers' licenses. Thousands of people applied, and on a whim, so did a group of friends that owned a patch of land near Goldendale in eastern Washington. They never really thought they'd win, so when they did, it came as a complete surprise. They all quit their 9-to-5 jobs, eager to embrace their new roles as the farmers of Tahoma Growers. Sound Effect contributors Alex Cartwright and Warren Langford caught up with two of the founding members, Brendan Cook and Shelby Talmadge, their friends, and they tell us how their romantic visions of living a rural life met the realities of running a pot farm.
Well, we were ecstatic. We felt so lucky and so privileged.
I was like, Mom, Dad, we made it. We don't have to live together no more.
Right at the beginning when everyone was fighting for permits, I know a guy that it cost $250 to get the permit, immediately sold it for $250,000. I mean, a lot of people were seeing that, and that was their whole plan, was to get the permit and sell it. So we got the permit and then immediately had to figure out how we were going to get electricity, water, build this fence with not much money. You know, we didn't have investment money.
And
so
then you have to meet their guidelines, and then they issue a license, and it's like a 3-strike rule. Like, you do it once, you fail, you do it twice, you fail, you do it 3 times, you fail. They're going to revoke your license because it's just not worth it to them. Tahoma Growers is located in beautiful Goldendale, Washington.
It's not somewhere you're going to visit unless you have something you have to see there.
We're coming into the winter, and the wind gusts around there are horrendous. Well, we would only work the farm every weekend, like try to build it, and then we'd go back to our daily jobs Monday through Friday and then drive 4 hours to Goldendale every weekend and build this farm. So we build the whole fence. We have it all done, and I'm getting ready to put the camera system in because that's the other part of the 502. You have to be under 100% surveillance. Well, we get this whole fence built. We leave all week, come back. We heard the windstorms were pretty bad. We come back, and like literally 3/4 of the fence is leveled when we get back there, just blown across the field. And then we had a fence inspector out there, and he was like, what are you guys doing? Like, you have to put actual posts in the ground and not metal T-bar. To be an outdoor grower in Eastern Washington, you could ask any of them. This year was tough. Last year, we were in tank tops and shorts in October trimming this weed. This year, we were bundled up in coats. It was raining the whole time. We're frantically trying to put covers over these plants because, you know, you start getting that moisture and humidity in the air. It just starts setting in on that bud. Right now, there's actually about three feet of snow over there, and it is making life hell. Like, we were in a hole before, and when you're, like, working in mud or whatever, it's one thing. But now that the snow has come, it's like we have deer trails, one to our grow, one to the cabin we built for staying out there, and then one to the fridge.
On the hottest day of the year, 102 degrees, we're like, let's order this shed kit. Not have him drop it off at the farm, but bring it down to the farm. There's three of us. One guy got heat stroke. I mean, we had never worked in that heat. We didn't know. We just didn't know.
There's just a ton of work. I don't think people realize. You think you just grow a plant and call it good. It's marijuana, you know? Like, you got to look at what people are making in the black market. And now it's legal and you can sell across the board. So you're automatically thinking like, oh, this is huge money. And then reality hits. It's like, well, there's also almost 300 other people doing the same thing you are at a scale 10 times the size of you.
And starting with investment money and starting with farm experience. At one point, we all lived in my house, one big happy family, a little two-bedroom. We had three big dogs, three adults, one baby, and all just trying to make it work, you know?
It was a dark time at Tahoma Growers. You're trudging uphill on everything. The insurance on a marijuana farm is ridiculous right now. It costs us money just to even hold a bank account, like big money. And it's still federally illegal, so it's not the easiest thing. There's always some hoop to jump through.
But it put definitely a strain on relationships that I thought were so solid that there's no way doing business together and going into business would ever shake those. And the reality of it is when you are that financially stressed, time stressed. I mean, we were driving 8 hours a weekend and working full-time jobs to try and get this off the ground. It's going to put a strain on those relationships.
There's a local shop in Goldendale, like a little breakfast joint that we all kind of meet up at, and there's a lot of old timers that know what we do, but they don't care, you know. I honestly think we've changed the perception of it a little bit. I think when we first started going in there, they're like, look at these punk ass kids trying to grow drugs on our land. And now that they know who we are and know our personalities and stuff, they've definitely warmed up to us. In the heat of the moment, there's definitely like, man, we should sell this.
Sell it. Get rid of
it. I think it's just going to get better with the years. If it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out.
I think, too, that just the potential of the marijuana industry, it's so new, and who knows what the limit's going to be. I mean, one day, say it's federally legalized. Who knows?
I think holding on at that point, like, it's not like we're dying.
There was no water. There was no electricity. To make that into a farm with no farm experience is such a cool thing. I mean, just that in itself, I will never look at Tahoma Growers as a failure because of that.
I think Tahoma Growers, if anything, it taught me a lot of patience. You know, like, it taught me a ton of patience to deal with everything.
You do seem very zen now.
Right?
This story was produced by Alex Cartwright and Warren Langford. It originally aired on the podcast Personal Effects. You can find a longer version of this story at personaleffectspodcast.com. You're tuned to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing, and today's theme is Turning Point. Off the coast of Fiji in the Pacific Ocean, beautiful, brightly colored coral reefs sit a few inches below translucent waves. And it's these unsuspecting reefs that changed everything for one family back in 1974. But before we get to Fiji, their story begins in the early 1970s in San Francisco Bay, where Chuck Wilcox and his wife Dawn loved to sail with their two kids, Garth and Linda. They'd glide through the waters of the protected bay, Chuck dreaming of life at sea and Dawn imagining all of the new places they could visit. Chuck and Dawn eventually asked, why not sail around the world? Why not show our kids what life is like beyond San Francisco?
So they went out and took all the navigation courses, learned how to fix diesel engines.
That's Garth, who was just 13 at the time they left California. Today, he's a naval architect in Seattle. He designs boats. And his wife, Wendy Hinman, wrote a book about the Wilcox family's adventures called Sea Trials, Around the World with Duct Tape and Baling Wire. Garth and Wendy came into the studio to talk about this epic trip. Garth's parents spent several years preparing for their voyage. And then in 1973, they left California on a 40-foot sailboat called the Vela. It means sail in Spanish. The family stopped first in Hawaii, then off to French Polynesia.
Then Cook Islands.
American Samoa.
And Western Samoa, followed by Tonga.
Covering thousands of miles of the Pacific Ocean. And this little family of sailors, they learned some hard lessons along the way, like the time they spent an entire month sailing right into the wind and the waves on their way to the Marquesas Islands.
We ripped every sail during that trip. We were in the doldrums, a place with no wind at all, and with only the storm jib. And my mom and I spent a lot of time sewing sails.
The family had a lot of equipment problems, but they also had some unforgettable adventures. There was the trip to the Polynesian kingdom of Tonga, a little collection of islands that was never colonized.
And strikingly, they were hunting whales in longboats, you know, under oar and sail, and hand harpoons.
And did you eat any?
Yes, they caught one when we were there, and we were pretty excited to get anything related to meat because we hadn't seen anything but canned corned beef for months. My mom and I rode over there and they put it in a big bag and tossed it to us and we went home and my mother had to figure out how to cook it. But she put it in the pressure cooker and it tasted pretty much like beef, actually.
After Tonga, the Wilcox family headed west to Fiji. The plan was to stop at Fiji's capital, Suva, and then sail south to New Zealand and wait out the hurricane season. But the cruise to Fiji was stormy. Clouds covered the stars, which was a problem. This was before GPS, and the family was finding their way around the world by using the stars and the sun as a guide.
You cannot take sights if you cannot see the stars or the sun. So you're just predicting your position based on speed and course, which over time gets more and more inaccurate.
So you spot land. It's the early morning hours on September 19th, 1974.
Mm-hmm. We spotted land in the form of a glow on the horizon, which was the capital city. That was right where we thought it should be, so we weren't way off course. But we were off course, unfortunately.
Fiji is filled with all of these outlying reefs.
That's Wendy Hinman, Garth's wife.
And they're submerged, and they're really difficult to see.
This is the middle of the night.
So it's 4 a.m., pitch black.
What happened?
Well, we hit the reef. It was a big crunch. The boat sort of comes to a stop, shudders. And in this case, the tide was high enough, and the breakers were big enough that they just picked the whole boat up and put us up on top of the reef, and very quickly.
What was the damage?
Well, in about an hour, we had a hole in the boat.
How big was this hole?
You could drive a car through it.
So you're on the reef. The sun is starting to come up. Mm-hmm. You guys realize you're in trouble. What do your parents do at this point?
Well, you're hanging on for dear life. Yeah. Water's everywhere.
We called for help on the radio. We shot off flares, all the standard stuff.
And as the sun rose, they could see a little island just half a mile away. Garth, who was now 14, and his parents put 11-year-old Linda into the life raft and waded to shore.
And we got to the island, My dad turned around, took a picture, thinking that was probably the last time we'd ever see the boat. And it was kind of a, well, now what do we do?
At this point, did you know if anyone was on their way to help you?
There wasn't. We had had no response to the radio, and apparently no one saw the flares.
And there was nothing on this island. It was just sand and scrub and a couple of mango trees.
Later that day, they were spotted. Garth's dad, Chuck, went to Suva for backup. A salvage company in Fiji told Chuck that the ship could not be saved. So they got as much of their stuff from the wreckage as they could. This was their home, after all.
I think our stamp albums got salvaged early on. My mother sacrificed her clarinet, much to her ongoing regret.
So the boat is destroyed. Most of their belongings are trashed. They go from the freedom of the wide open water to renting a house in Suva. To make a little extra money, Chuck and Don strip the inside of the Vela. They sell everything from cushions to the kitchen sink. Time to head back to California and be grateful for the adventures that were had and for the fact that no lives were lost. This is what most of us would do, right? Well, Garth and his family were almost about to make this turn back to the States, but then a glimmer of hope. A different salvage company tells them, hey, the boat, it can be saved.
By this point, the boat has been out on the reef for like 6 weeks, several storms, getting battered, getting driven further and further onto the reef, and of course, you know, shoveling coral and ripping a bigger hole every time it moves further onto the reef.
Yeah, but they got us to Suva, in, you know, still afloat. We hauled the boat out the next day with the only crane possible that Fiji had.
The Vela would live on, but she needed to be rebuilt. Before the crash, Garth had been a solid handyman on the ship. But after the wreck, at the ripe old age of 15, he became a third partner in this venture.
My parents had prepared the boat pretty much by themselves. But now I was doing, let's say a third of the work to repair the boat. I was doing that myself. So I had invested my own self into this project at that point.
What did you do?
Well, we hired a firm to help us patch the hull, but then we had to rebuild the entire interior of the boat. It had been gutted by the reef.
Filled with barnacles and sand. And
yeah. So first thing we did was redesign the interior so that it worked better for the four of us. So we moved the galley around and changed the settees and added a bunk. And so I drew that up, and then we had to make it happen. So I with my father, rebuilt the entire interior of the boat.
So you did the redesign?
Yeah.
How long did this process take?
I want to say 10 months. Working in the tropics is brutally hot. It was very hard work. But we eventually got the boat back in the water, and off we went.
How did this wreck shape the rest of the trip?
It was really completely different after that.
In what way?
We had used an extra year that we didn't really have. A good chunk of the money that was supposed to get us around the world, we had spent it fixing the boat up. The other thing that changed is we had all invested so much in that rebuilding process that I don't think anyone was really willing to give up. And what crept up on us over time was that the equipment problems were pretty serious. We spent the rest of the trip just patching the boat up to get it to the next port.
There was the storm during which they had no sails for reducing sail. And so they took all the sails down and were running bare poles, and they got rolled and smashed in one of the windows. And so water's gushing inside, and there's water several feet deep.
Because we had to pump.
Yeah. And because of that, they decided that they didn't want to go around the Cape of Storms, the Cape of Good Hope. So they decided instead to go through the Suez Canal, which had just reopened.
Yeah, we knew nothing about sailing in the Red Sea. I think the Cape of Storms would have been easier.
Yeah, the Cape of Storms didn't have pirates, gunboats, mines, thieves.
Yeah, it just had
two
storms.
Hostile nations. Yeah.
So you had a lot of near misses from that point on, from salvaging the boat, repairing it, and then the rest of your cruise. It was not a smooth ride.
No, nothing smooth about it. It was pretty much a struggle.
How did the dynamics change in your family?
I continued really enjoying the experience, frankly. I like the challenge of it, I think. My father, he wasn't liking it anymore, but he was determined to finish it somehow.
It also changed the dynamic between you and your father. Chuck was the leader of the family initially, and through the voyage, Garth started to take the lead and almost became the captain by the end of this voyage. Chuck was just so frustrated. He had done so many things to try and keep that boat going, and he just was fried, and he kind of gave up a couple of times.
Do you remember having to step in and be the captain for your dad?
Well, he told me. He appointed me captain one day, and then I had to figure out what to do.
How old were you?
I was probably 15.
What'd you think?
I didn't want to be the captain in particular, and I didn't know how long he was going to feel that way. So what we did was we turned around and headed for the nearest port and just had a cool down period, and things were better after that.
You were 13 years old when this voyage started, and by the time you got back, you and your family made it back to San Francisco Bay, and mm-hmm. you were 18 years old. How did this shape your worldview when you got back to land?
So most of my skills that I had developed were completely irrelevant to being on land. You know, I didn't have to know how to navigate, stand a watch, you know, steer during a storm. I had to know how to study in college, and that was really hard. But it turns out to be very valuable in my career. I design boats for a living, and I need to come up with creative solutions to new problems. And that's exactly what I learned how to do on this cruise.
After their trip around the world, Garth's mom, Dawn, and his sister, Linda, never sailed again. But Garth, he continues to love the open water. In fact, he did another around-the-world trip, this time with Wendy. He says it was a lot more relaxing than the first adventure. You can read more about the Wilcox family and their travels in Wendy's book, Sea Trials, Around the World with Duct Tape and Bailing Wire. That's it for the show this week. Sound Effect comes to you from producers Kevin Kniestad, Allie Ferguson, and Kyle Norris. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. We get web help from Dave Nagaris. Parker Miles Blum helps with photos and video production. Special thanks this week goes out to Alex Cartwright and Warren Langford. Our intern is the wonderful Amanda Abbott. Thank you for all of your work. And you can find Sound Effect on the NPR One app. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. We'll be back next week when our theme is underwater.
Something to do, I guess, go out and wrestle an octopus. So since we have the largest octopus in the world in shallow water, we decided, well, it might be a nice event to try and run and do.
I'm Jennifer Wing, and this is 88.5 KNKX.